and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. In today's episode, I speak with H. Bruce Franklin, who's written a book on, I guess it's hard to say in one sentence, he was an Air Force pilot with the Strategic Air Command. He describes himself as having been a very strong anti-communist, pro-Joe McCarthy kind of guy, but over time, he became something of an activist, an anti-war activist. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with H. Bruce Franklin, author of Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
So tell me, how did you get into studying and writing about history?
You know, I started actually in high school. Did a whole thing on the Franco-Prussian War in high school. So I don't know, I guess it was really growing up in World War II and getting acculturated in that. So, like other boys in World War II that made model fighter planes and bombers and followed the war, you know, I had over my bed, I had this big map with pins with the flags of the various countries following the battle lines in all theaters of the war. So, you know, when got acculturated into being a war fan.
Tell me then about this book.
Well, yeah, I'm 84 years old. So, yeah, as a book in World War II, gung-ho, and then looking back, I'm thinking August 14th, 1945. I'm 11 years old. I'm in the back of a pickup truck with a bunch of other kids. And we're part of an impromptu motorcade in Brooklyn around our neighborhood. And everybody's pouring out of their homes, out of the streets, people waving flags and cheering and dancing in the streets. And we kids in the truck are screaming our hearts out. Peace, peace, the war is over. And we really believed this was it. You know, we'd won, this is VJ Day, that we were going to live in a peaceful nation, a prosperous nation, in a peaceful world. And looking back, we've been in and out of wars ever since. Now, we've reached the point where we're in a forever war. We're a permanent war economy. We're fighting so many wars that nobody can count how many we're actually fighting. We're getting into a discussion about the numbers, whether we need to count them on our fingers or not. So, and then I became after this, I became part of the culture. I became a gung-ho, anti-communist. Douglas MacArthur was my hero. Joe McCarthy was my hero. And then I flew in the Strategic Air Command as a navigator and squadron intelligence officer. And I began to find things, facts and my own experience, that were just blowing holes in my basic beliefs about our government and the military and the world, and learning that the Soviet Union was not threatening the United States. They had no means to attack the United States. This is all made up. We're mid-air refueling. We were refueling bombers that were penetrating Soviet airspace, and one kind of mission was reconnaissance. They were going sometimes pretty far in. And the other mission was provocation. And, I knew the difference between the two missions because of my position in intelligence. Then, you see, what are we doing? So that began to change my vision. Looking back on that, I'm really embarrassed. You know, people say thank you for your service. You don't know what you're talking about, because we launched three times, and were barely recalled. And what I'm so embarrassed about and alarmed about is that, you know, this could have been it. This could have been a full-scale thermonuclear war. That never, not for an instant, did I ever ask the question of myself, should I be doing this? So, I didn't think this at the time. I thought of it looking back. So, this is a long answer to your question. So the book is this. Okay. How did we get into this? So sometimes it's like a maze. You go in a maze and you find yourself in some place you can't get out. Well, the only way to get out is to figure out how you got in. You gotta retrace your steps to find your way out. So that's what the book is about. The book is about the history that got us to where we are, into this forever war. And it's about my personal history of consciousness participating in that history. So I think that just plain history, for most people, you know, it's names and dates, and it's like a lecture, a lesson, and so, you know, it's something, you know, it's a very other for people. But each of us lives a life, and you know, one of the powers of fiction is that you get to participate with a character. Well, this is not fiction, it's nonfiction. But what I'm doing is offering myself and my experience as a way for people to participate in the history. And what I'm hoping for is that younger people will read the book.
I did an interview few months ago with someone who wrote about the first 18 years of Strategic Air Command, and I asked the question, how much did the personal religious beliefs of the pilots come into this? And I was told, well, they didn't. They were basically picked and trained to be very efficient men who followed orders, and they just did as they were told, regardless of the moral implications of what they were doing. And that it worked efficiently because of that. So I'm curious, since you flew for SAC, did, you know, what's your opinion on that?
Well, you know, I think that we were very good at what we did. I think we took a great pride in how we did our jobs. We spent a great deal of responsibility to each other. What was it, you know, particularly true, I guess, in multi-engine flying, you know, you're part of a crew. And there was pretty much unquestioned belief in our country and our mission. And I went into the Air Force believing that we were saving the world from this Soviet menace. The Soviet Union was trying to take over the world, and communism was this great menace to our society, and that we were the first line of defense. So I don't think people had questions, but the chapter on the Air Force that's in the book, it's called 13 Confessions of a Cold Warrior. And a lot that was going on certainly convinced me, and I think for many other men, raised serious questions about, you know, what we were doing, what was it, what was that. There were things in in the daily missions that raised real issues about, what was this really all about? I mean, just to pick one example. My first mission, as a combat-ready navigator, and I had an instrument in mid-air refueling. It was a four-plane cell, we call it a cell formation. And it consisted of two KC-97 G models and two KC-97 F models. And the two G's were number one, number two. We were the lead plane. Because it was my first mission, there was an instructor navigator along with me to supervise, what I did and help me out if necessary. So he said, hey, Bruce, be careful, watch out, after takeoff to get the position of the F's, because they, of course, are faster than the G's, because the G's have these external underwing tanks, which make them a lot heavier. So I said, so why are we number one or two if they're faster than my clan flew it? He said, well, it's Boeing. They just sell all this crap to the Air Force to make more profits. And so on paper, the G's are, according to Boeing, faster than the F. Not that this makes any sense. So we take off, and the visibility was horrible. I said, hey, Dave, what are these two blips over here? Oh my God, he said, those are the ants, they're climbing right through us, they're almost in us. And that was the beginning. The rest of that mission, and this is just, I described that mission in quite a bit of detail in the book, because there was lesson after lesson learned on that mission, including the bombers that we were refueling, in conditions which we weren't supposed to be refueling them. It was very dangerous. We almost had a collision. Were on their way to the Soviet Union. Really? I suppose I sound very naive in 2018 talking about this, but to me this was very shocking.
What year was that?
This was 57. Either late 56 or early 57.
So mentioning Boeing, how much do you think the rise of the military-industrial complex since, I guess, 45, let's say, end of World War II, how much has that contributed to, this idea of just wars continuing on and on?
Well, on the simplest level, follow the money is always good advice. So you think about it, the end of World War II, here the United States has built up the most colossal productive machine ever in history. We could mass produce strategic weapons in unbelievable ways. The rest of the world that had been involved in the war was in shambles. The Soviet Union, of course, was a complete mess. They lost 30 million people during the war. Europe was a mess. Japan, of course, was practically a desert, and so on. Now it's true that there was some pent-up demand during the war for automobiles and washing machines and refrigerators and stuff like that. That took some of it, but the productive capability of the nation was way beyond that. So, on that very simple level, the war scare of the early post-war years, the 46, 47, 48, was designed to provide lots of jobs and money for this war industry that we'd built up during the war.
So, looking through the book, I see that you mentioned sort of issues that you... Well, first, let me ask, how long were you in the Air Force before you...
3 years.
3 years, okay. How much did sort of domestic problems, you mentioned civil rights, racial issues, and that sort of thing in the book, how did that compare between that and your feelings that the Soviet Union wasn't the enemy that it was portrayed as? How did those two play out as far as your personal feelings about all this?
Well, that's a short question. And the book is the answer to that, because what I try to do in the book is to show the interconnections of all the parts. Mm-hmm. And so the awareness of the legacy of slavery, of our segregated society, mm-hmm. was, you know, very much part of our consciousness and experience. Now, it's interesting, you in the Air Force, in fact, at least in our unit, we were with all, there were no black people in our flying in our unit, but things were happening. So Jackie Robinson's entry into the Brooklyn Dodgers, that was the main factor in my life. So there was this awareness that although we believe that we live with this wonderful democracy, the greatest democracy in the world, and so forth, There were these contradictions, and I guess and this is very important in my life, and I think it relates to a lot of the divisions in the society today. By a strange series of coincidences, I ended up marrying a farm girl from North Carolina. Jane, we've been married 62 years now. Mm-hmm. And although we've been married 62 years, we're still learning from each other about America. And this has been quite formative for both of us. I learned that although I grew up in the North, I was the one who lived in a segregated society, not her. Mm-hmm. She lived in a society that had legal segregation to divide people who were living together and funneling them into separate schools. So the legal segregation in the South was there to separate races that were actually living together, whereas my experience, races were not living together. They had practically no contact, as neighbors and so forth. So that's just the first layer here. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of other experience. I worked in a factory on the waterfront in New York, where probably all the other workers were from Puerto Rico. I was one of the only two or three English-speaking people working there. Mm-hmm. Then I worked as a tugboat mate on Pennsylvania Railroad tugboats in New York Harbor during what was actually a war that was being waged on the waterfront. That chapter is called On the Waterfront. Mm-hmm. And all these disparate things seemed to have very little to do with each other. But it was during the Vietnam War that for me and for millions, I believe tens of millions of Americans, the awareness of what that war was really about brought us to have to confront the word empire and imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
And once you confronted that, things started to fit together. My education, for example, I mean, I was an English major in college, and then I got my PhD in English and American literature. Through all those years of education, I had never, not once, been asked to read a single work by a writer of color.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that? What does that have to do with the Vietnam War or the Korean War? You know, why are we fighting all these wars against people of color?
Mm-hmm.
So all those things came together. I mentioned earlier the experience of August 14th, 1945,
mm-hmm.
Where we're talking about the yelling and screaming because we believe we live in a world of peace. That was exactly the same day, that day, August 14th, when the August Revolution began in Vietnam.
Hmm.
And in a few weeks, the Vietnamese overthrew the Japanese occupiers and established the Democratic Republic of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
On September 2nd, just a few weeks later, they celebrated the founding of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in Hanoi, 500,000 people. And Ho Chi Minh read their Declaration of Independence,
mm-hmm.
which began with our Declaration of Independence. Who knew this? While this is going on, suddenly two warplanes appear overhead. They're P-138. They're weird-looking fighter plane or fighter bomber. And the crowd looks up, sees the American planes, and like one person, 500,000 people cheer,
mm-hmm.
because they knew that we would support their independence. Of course, they didn't know that back on August 22nd, about 10 days earlier, De Gaulle had come to Washington. Truman had agreed with De Gaulle that we would finance a French invasion of Vietnam, that we would supply all the equipment, we would support it, we would divert a dozen troops ships from bringing GIs home from France to transport that French army to invade, and the army would consist in large part of Foreign Legion soldiers, including Waffen SS troops,
mm-hmm.
that we had essentially given to the French, who were then forced into the French Foreign Legion. Meanwhile, the British had landed, had rearmed the Japanese. Japanese warplanes and the RAF were conducting joint missions, bombing and strafing the Vietnamese. So when the troop ships got to Saigon in the late fall of 45, they were greeted on the docks by rearmed, uniformed Japanese soldiers who saluted them above the arriving troop troops. There was a tower with machine guns manned by Japanese soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
So every single enlisted man on those troop troops signed a petition denouncing, quote, imperialism, and demanding to know why we were doing this to the people of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning of the anti-war movement that we're talking about, the late fall of 1945. Hmm. People, you know, people don't know this history, but that's one way of putting the pieces together.
Mm-hmm. Now, how difficult was it for you? At what point did you sort of switch? What was it, like a sudden switch or gradual, as far as going from anti-communist to questioning what was going on, you know, in a big way?
Oh, you know, it wasn't a single event, and that's kind of the core of Crash Course. So the Crash Course, because it's in, you know, 300 pages, but we're talking about decades of life. So it was a lot of different events. Mm-hmm. It was the Cuban Missile Crisis, big time. It's hard to recapitulate, I think, for people in the 21st century what it meant to be aware that our leaders had just risked all our lives. Mm-hmm. For what? What was the real issue here? Jane and I became, we were active in civil rights stuff, and we're active, you know, in peace stuff. It's, you know, good liberals. The deeper we got into the anti-war movement, the more we were forced to see connections, why there were contradictions in our experience and so forth. And I guess one very formative event was the anti-napalm movement that many of us launched in Redwood City, California. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, Jane and I went for a year in France. I was teaching at Stanford in France for half a year, and then was on sabbatical for half a year in Paris, and that's when we began to work, you know, with the Vietnamese, learning incredible amounts about American history, world history, and being involved in what was essentially revolutionary experience, because we were directly participating in the formation of the deserted movement, mm-hmm. which played a very important military role, actually, in the history of the Vietnam War. So by this time, I think it would be fair to say that we were on the other side.
Mm-hmm. So you bring up something that I want to also ask about. Your fellow Air Force officers or Air Force service members, did you keep in touch with any of them, and or did you notice similar changes with some of them?
No, I didn't. Well, I didn't really keep up. There was one major exception to that when I went. I had to get out of the Air Force. I went to graduate school at Stanford to get my PhD. And a pilot from my squadron was living in the old World War II Quonset huts, where they had graduate student housing, two doors from us. And there was a guy, a captain in our squadron, who was the worst screw up I think I've ever met in my life. The guy was a total menace in the air. Mm-hmm. And there's a long story in the book, but he almost killed squadron commander, the fleet people at his first landing. Nobody knew what to do with this guy. So George, the other, this pilot who lived 2 doors from us in graduate housing, one day burst into our little apartment there and with a newspaper. This guy had been put in charge of the first operational intercontinental ballistic missile. So that was the one exception, I think, to contact. So we did that. Recently I published an article about the B-47s that were disintegrating, which we became aware of when one blew up right behind us. A guy who was a pilot of B-47s just got in contact with me 2 days ago. He was exactly the same age I was, in the same time, and we had a very long and interesting conversation about our experience in SAC. He was on the receiving end of the fuel that we were pumping from the Tiger into his B-47.
So I was going to ask, I guess, the Korean War. I guess you were still young when that occurred, and I guess you would have been, completely pro-U.S., or I don't want to put it that way. You would have been behind the war completely in that instance.
Absolutely.
How do you feel like something about Korea now, you know?
Okay, so yes, I mean, so during the war, I described this in the book. I was actually working in a photo finishing factory that was owned by two men who were high-ranking officials in the Communist Party. And I was ardent or anti-communist. So that very interesting stuff came out there. But I pretty much accepted the basic narrative of the Korean War, which people today really need to discard and get back to the truth of this, to understand the perspective of people in both North Korea and South Korea on the history. I mean, this is a nation that was a single nation for a couple of thousand years, long before they were the United States of America. How did it come to be two countries? I think people sort of assume that there's some agreement between the Soviet Union and the United States, and Britain in there too, dividing Korea. Not true. Before the war ended, on August, there was the night of August 11th, 12th, somebody in the U.S. government, the Pentagon, the White House, it's a little unclear, where this decision was reached, decided that we should divide Korea. And so a colonel in the Army, Dean Rusk, who later became Secretary of State, was given the job of drawing a line across Korea to divide it in two. He was given 40 minutes to do this. He had an old National Geographic map, and so he looked at the map. He said, "Oh, there's the capital, Seoul. So we'll make it 38th parallel. That way, we get Seoul." Now, I'm not making this stuff up. Gene Rusk provides most of the details in his autobiography. What were we doing there? What was this all about? The largest land battles and the most decisive in the Pacific area was the battle between the Soviet Union and the Japanese main force army on the Asian mainland, which, contrary to our notion that the Japanese army would fight to the death. They gave up. They were overwhelmed. This, I mean, it wasn't a token fighting. 30,000 Russian soldiers died in this, but hundreds of Japanese generals surrendered. The entire army surrendered. So the Soviet forces reached the northern border of Korea, were actually coming into Korea, and they included the Korean forces that had been fighting against the Japanese. So if Washington had not decided to divide Korea into two, that story would, I guess, have ended with the establishment of a Korean government, an anti-fascist, anti-Japanese Korean government of the nation of Korea. Although we had divided it on paper, literally on paper, we had no means to get U.S. forces to Korea for another 6 weeks. When we got there, we took somebody, Seaman Lee, who was living in the United States, not fighting against the Japanese, like the head of the government that was being set up in Korea. Seaman Lee. We flew him there and set up a government, which used, just like in Vietnam, used the Japanese forces to set up that puppet government. And then the government that we created depended almost entirely on the wealthy classes that had collaborated with the Japanese occupiers ever since the Japanese occupation began in 1905. I'm not making this stuff up. I include in the book a CIA report from 1948, which explains all this. A report which says that the government in the North was satisfying the needs of the people, the unified government. The government in the South was a dictatorship, which rested on the rich people who had collaborated with the Japanese and so forth. Let me just say that one of the things I've done in the book, we historians use archival research a lot. Well, until recently, archival research depended on going to libraries and accessing documents and so forth. But thanks to our technology, many of those archives are now available online. So I've tried wherever I could in the book to cite archival sources which are available online. So the CIA report that I just mentioned, the 1948 report, is online. I give the URL for it, that people can read it themselves. So that's the origin of the division of Korea, and the dictatorship that we established in the South waged the civil war against the people, the poor people of the South, killing at least 100,000 people in their repression. So the war did not begin suddenly on the 38th parallel. The fighting had been going on for weeks at the 38th parallel, and the desire for the Korean of the Korean people to have a reunited government has been there ever since the division took place in 45, a division that we imposed on Korea.
Interesting. So let me turn to the resources you used for your research. So much of the book is sort of something of your personal history and feelings and development. But how much other, what other materials did you bring in? You mentioned a few already, but can you expand on that?
Let's say there's a lot of archival stuff. Whenever possible, I've used primary sources. And I mean by that, I gave an example. Rather than say, having my opinion, you'll go to Dean Rusk, the guy who actually drew the line across Korea, go to his autobiography and cite the pages in that book. So, because I know that the history that I'm giving, the crash course of the title, the history that I'm giving contradicts what most people believe to be the truth about U.S. Soviet relations in the 40s, about the beginning of the Vietnam War, about the beginnings of the Korean War, what happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and so on. I've used sources for the historical material that I think you can't really argue against. This is not the first book in which I've done that. Several of my books have challenged the official history of things. And I've given my sources, and although not everybody accepts my narrative of events, nobody has ever seriously been able to challenge any of the facts that I've presented. I'm aware that whatever I say, some people are going to say, "Hey, well, that can't be true," and they're going to try to attack. But the attacks have never been successful in disproving or even casting significant doubt about the facts that I offer as part of the history.
Yeah, I'll note that your book is extensively footnoted, so it seems like, as you say, anything you put out there, people can go back to the sources to see for themselves.
It's really crucial to know a good source from a bad source. I mean, again, one of the things I mentioned earlier about the the crewmen on the ships that brought the French invasion army to Saigon in the fall of 45. That research was done by somebody who was in the National Maritime Union and went into the archives of the Union and found all these documents. Just amazing stuff, and it takes the Burns Novak history and blows it apart. It didn't come after the history, it came before the history that material was available. So it's not like the war started because out of our good intentions and so forth. It was an imperialist war from day one, as was the division of Korea was an imperialist move. That's what it was.
Interesting. So, despite the subject matter of the book, can you say there was something, can you talk about what was most enjoyable about doing this research?
I like doing research. For me, it was very complicated because going back into history and at the same time going back into your own consciousness and finding that things that you believe weren't true. I think of Douglas MacArthur who I, like, probably all Americans admired Douglas MacArthur, great, great hero. And going back and looking at his, not only the biggest, one of the biggest blunders in military history, which was responsible for the catastrophes in Korea, but even before that, in his non-defense of the Philippines. I hadn't really realized that he had at his disposal a whole fleet of B-17 flying fortresses and brand new P-40s fighters, which were all wiped out on the ground. As he saved his ass, abandoned his troops, and staged his dramatic, not "we shall return," but "I shall return." That was interesting.
What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
Well, the research went, the research for the book extended way back before I began the book. So, the research into the beginnings of the Vietnam War, the beginnings of the Korean War. I guess the single biggest surprise I got in research, and this was a surprise. We had a military wedding, Jane and I, back in 56. I was married in uniform, her two brother-in-laws, one was a Marine colonel, the other was a captain in the Navy, and he cut our wedding cape with his ceremonial sword. Mm-hmm. It was only in the late stages of the research for this book, I think about a year ago, that I discovered that his name was Bill Morgan, the Navy captain. He was captain of a destroyer in the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was the one who was, his destroyer was dropping the depth charges on the Soviet submarine that, unbeknownst to anybody in the United States, was armed with a nuclear torpedo. It wasn't that submarine was very close to Cuba. It was out in the Atlantic Ocean, in the Sargasso Sea. And because they were dropping these so-called practice depth charges on the submarine, that the submarine had to stay silent. It couldn't run its diesel. They were running out of oxygen. It was turning to a furnace. They were dying. And they had to make a decision, either surface and surrender or launch their nuclear torpedo. And their command and control, similar to the present situation with command and control, the top two officers had the decision to make, and the captain and his immediate aide officer decided that the only honorable thing to do was to launch the nuclear torpedo, and they were going to launch it at the aircraft carrier that was the main ship in this submarine hunting flotilla. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that they didn't launch was that the commander of the four submarines happened to be on board that submarine, and he said yet and vetoed. So they essentially surrendered. They came to the surrendered. When I think about it, that's the easiest question to answer. The biggest surprise was my own brother-in-law, the guy who cut the wedding cake, was the guy, which he didn't know, was responsible for coming real, real, real close to sparking a full-scale thermonuclear holocaust.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what would have been the reaction if a nuclear torpedo from the Soviets had downed a U.S. aircraft carrier. That, wow.
Well, the whole flotilla would have gone.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so it's no secret because LeMay and the rest of the Joint Chiefs, they were furious that Kennedy was not going to invade Cuba. I mean, they didn't know about the nuclear torpedoes on these four subs, nor did they know that the Soviet troops in Cuba were on tactical nukes and had orders to use the tactical nukes if the United States invaded. So, you know, we, at the time, you know, we knew that it was a close call, but we had no idea how close it was. I mean, the Joint Chiefs did not know about those tactical nukes in Cuba, nor did they know about those nuclear torpedoes on the submarines. And you know, you just have to ask, you know, was it worth it? You know, this is the question. Now, this is wonderful. Promote somebody else's book, Dan Ellsberg's The Doomsday Machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're still on hair trigger, and now we have these two nuclear arsenals, even one of which launched would be the end of human civilization for sure,
mm-hmm.
and a good chance of exterminating our species, and we say, you know, why? We're the only species so brilliant, so smart, that we've been able to figure out the means to exterminate ourselves, and not only figure it out, but deploy it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not smart enough to figure out how to get rid of it. Most people don't understand the dangers that we're in. When one reason they don't is because they think that the only person who can order a nuclear attack in the United States is the President of the United States. We have all these movies with the President carrying around the so-called football, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the authority and the ability to launch a nuclear war is widely dispersed. There's at least hundreds of people who have the ability to do it. And we've come close many, many times.
So was there a particular issue or question that was very difficult for you to research or come to a conclusion on, or maybe you still haven't found an answer you're satisfied with?
Some of it gets lost in the thicket of bureaucratic decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
So, think back on, I brought one up already, you know, who was it who actually made the decision, hey, let's divide Korea into two nations?
Mm-hmm.
Who made that decision? I don't think we really know. We know something about, what happened on August, 22nd, when de Gaulle came to Truman. That's been written about some. There's some good primary documents on that, but we don't really know how that decision was reached. These were two decisions that had enormous implications. And one question that I do leave with some question marks in the book is I don't really understand completely how it's possible to change our consciousness so swiftly from the wartime consciousness in which the Soviets were our heroic allies to that post World War II consciousness of the absolutely bizarre, ridiculous belief that the Soviet Union was a threat to the United States, that they were trying to take over the world, and so forth. I mean, how did my own consciousness change so fast? And Jane and I, Jane had the same experience. We've talked about that a lot. We can't quite figure it out, you know, how did it happen so fast?
Yeah, that is a very interesting question. It was pretty quick.
It's sort of like 1984. Yeah, it's one of the things that novel deals with.
Well, I think military leaders were already thinking that way, you know, within the private circles. As the war was ending, but as far as the American public, yeah, that's the really interesting bit about it.
And again, there's another thing I do deal with in that book, 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've made the main objective of our public policy was defeating communism, stopping the USSR, blah, blah, the USSR, etc. And so, 1991, USSR disintegrates, doesn't exist, goodbye communism, and okay, now we get our peace dividend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the year that the Forever War began.
Yeah.
That's Iraq.
Yeah.
Iraq was our ally.
Mm-hmm.
We provided all kinds of assistance to Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran. So, you know, how'd that happen? All of a sudden, whoosh.
Yeah, it's like the U.S. decided once the Cold War was over, then it was, we'll be the policemen of the world.
We're already the policemen of the world, but that was kind of the role of the cops has been switched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's switched. You know, it switched in 1945. All of a sudden, we were allied with the Japanese in Vietnam and Korea, and then in 1991, all of a sudden. Well, it wasn't exactly all of a sudden because I go into some stuff about Lebanon, our invasion of Lebanon in 1958, and some surprises there. But as far as you know, we sort of sat still for that, although the demonstrations against the Iraq War showed that the anti-war movement of the late 60s and early 70s had not gone away. It's still there. Mm-hmm. And actually, the book begins with a meditation on all the hawks who are whining and complaining about the war-weary American public. Because I don't know anybody who supports these wars.
Mm-hmm.
Not anybody. And I spend time with all kinds of people. different classes, races, and so forth. I just don't know where the support for these wars exists. Other than, you know, talk about follow the money and things like that. But.
Right. Yeah. So can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book finished or published and how you overcame those?
Well, the only the real difficulty, I didn't have trouble finishing the book, but the publication, I had to make a decision because most of the big commercial publishers are going for what they call high concept books, that are books that you can describe in a single sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a book you can describe in a single sentence, you know, because I'm trying to do a whole lot of different things in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to make a decision whether to try to go for a big corporate publisher or not. And then one factor there is that I've published with the corporate publishers before, and it has not been a very satisfactory experience. I think the publishers that are putting out some of the most valuable books these days are the university presses that have moved into a niche that the big corporate publishers have abandoned of certain kinds of serious nonfiction books that are not designed to be bestsellers, but are designed to have kind of deep value and lasting value. So the Rutgers University Press has a series called Cultures of War, which was the ideal home for the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why I went with Rutgers.
Okay. What's your next writing project?
Yeah, after my previous book, I vowed I would never write another book. So I don't know. I have some bullets, but I don't know. And in fact, it takes a while for things to germinate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see that.
At least for me.
You did write that one article that you sent me about the tankers, the B-47?
Yeah, well, that's comes pretty much from the book.
Oh, okay. 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 Where can people find your books and your writings?
Okay, yeah. So thanks for asking that, Chris. I have a website called, it's really easy, it's my name, hbrucefranklin.com. No punctuation. hbrucefranklin.com. And there's information about this book, all my other books, how to order it. It's also got an events page where people can, you know, tune into radio broadcasts or go to book signings that I'm going to be doing, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it also includes my address, so it's I don't keep that private.
Mm-hmm. And the books can be found on, I guess, the regular book online bookstores and the press sites, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, Amazon is always easy. I like to encourage people to order books at their local independent bookstore to keep them alive, you know, in this difficult times for independent retailers in general.
Mm-hmm.
But they provide a real service.
Well, that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final words or thoughts?
I could go on forever, I guess. I just hope the overwhelming thought is I believe, maybe naively, maybe too idealistically, but I believe if the American people knew the history that had gotten into the Forever War, the American people would find out how to get us out.
Mm-hmm.
And who would find the political means necessary to get us out. And I don't give up on the possibility of our living in a peaceful world. I think it's up to us to make it possible. I don't think there's any other force to decide it's up to us, and that's why I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Chris.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.